When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome to another podcast at slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, our friends with MTI, Madison Teachers, Madison Teepsters Local 695, and Madison Firefighters Local 311. Joining us now, Peter Rickman. He's in Milwaukee. He's the executive director of MASH, the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Association, or organization, I should say. I almost got that right, pretty close. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Sly, and I'm quite impressed that you got almost all that acronym. It was like 95% right.
That's an A. I'm writing myself down a great big A. I certainly didn't get those when I was in college.
You've always been an A-plus in my book.
All right, your organization has endorsed Malin Mitchell for governor. Let's start out with that. Plenty of good progressives running for governor. Why did you pick Malin?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, in a field of folks who are running to take on Walker, and not a one of them has shied away from the fight, saying that, you know, they want to stand up for working people. It seemed to us as an organization, a union of service and hospitality workers, that Malin Mitchell had the combination of the best plan to actually build the power working people need to raise wages and the commitment with a track record behind it to make it seem like this is the thing that he would prioritize as our governor. And the truth is, our state needs a governor whose number one priority is going to be building the power of working people to raise wages so we can get this economy working for the rest of us, not just the billionaire class and the 1%.
And what is his plan?
Well, I think it's important to take a step back, Sly, and understand what the problem is. You know, we don't have a problem of education and training. We don't have a problem here with the number of jobs that exist. The truth is, we've never had a more educated and trained workforce. The truth is, we've got all the jobs that folks could possibly want. In fact, some people are getting even two or three of these jobs. The issue here is that the jobs that exist in our state simply don't pay enough. We've had an explosion of low-wage, largely service sector jobs that have replaced the utter decimation of the blue-collar working class jobs that built the middle class in our state, the factories and foundries, you know, that dotted the landscape from Neenah to Milwaukee on up to Eau Claire. You know, the kinds of jobs that once built the middle class are gone. And what's replaced them are low-wage service sector jobs. And with so many of those and a labor law that does not meet the realities of the 21st century, working people have lost the power that we need to actually raise wages and raise standards in the labor market.
You call this the rigged economy.
Absolutely. The billionaire class and the 1% corporate interests, you know, they've rigged this economy to their benefit. And it's not some magic of market, Sly. There's no free market fundamentalist God who's waving a wand from on high saying, well, this is how it must be. Working people must struggle with stagnant to declining wages for four decades. We need to eliminate health care coverage through employment and defined benefit pension plans. That's not actually how it works, Sly. The truth is, living wage standards, things like benefits, and as well as decent working conditions and fair treatment on the job, are a matter of power. And the billionaire class on Wall Street, the 1% that's rigged the economy, has systematically destroyed the institutions that build bargaining power in the labor market for workers. Now, you and I know, all your listeners know, that unions have been under attack for decades, generations. It's not just Act 10 and Right to Work. This goes back, you know, quite literally, even to the start of American private sector labor law in the 1930s. It was a system built for a different kind of economy, but had enough tripwires in it so that the boss class could retain the power in the labor market that they wanted. Instead of sharing it equally with workers, they still kept some of it.
Yeah, Mike Rosen wrote a wonderful piece on, it's actually a very tragic piece, about what happened in Wisconsin and the decline of workers in Wisconsin going back to the 70s, where literally these companies started to break unions and right to work laws, obviously.
Dr. Michael Rosen, a mentor and a friend. And I think people like Mike and others have noted that there was a turn in the 70s, that corporate interests and the billionaire class, they decided that they wanted to take what was left of the power that was in the hands of workers and get it back themselves, because more power in their hands meant more profits in their pockets. And they exploited the loopholes in a labor law that, you know, even at the time it was adopted, was far from perfect. But, you know, in the 80 years since it was adopted, has magnified its shortcomings and no longer does anything for the dominant part of our economy, the service sector. Let me give you an example here, Sly, because I think this illustrates the best what is wrong with the way that our institutions to build the power of workers in the labor market. It illustrates how poorly our system has been built for workers. And it also points in the direction of what can be done different. Now, in the 1940s, the UAW, the preeminent industrial union of its time, sort of the archetype of that era's system of collective bargaining, they won representation of the workers employed by Ford at a plant called River Rouge outside of Detroit. 50,000 plus workers in one place, one union, one contract, set the pace with living wages, benefits, fair treatment on the job for 50,000 workers. Now, in Milwaukee, for example, where I am right now and where our union is building the struggle amongst low-wage service and hospitality workers, you've got 50,000 people employed in this sector spread out across hundreds, probably thousands of work sites across the city. Now, there's no union contract bargaining thing that happens on a shop-by-shop basis when there's, you know, 25 to 200 people employed in any given place. The labor law that we have says that's the way it's got to be done, but the truth is that doesn't match how the service economy works in the 21st century. And the fact is, without an effective labor law to build worker power and what's been done to decimate the minimum wage as the other major institution to raise standards in labor markets, working folks aren't going to have a chance to actually build our power to raise wages and economic standards. So we do need a new plan to do something with it. Once we understand what the problem is, then we can figure out what the solution is. And I think that's where Malin has really distinguished himself thus far on the campaign trail. He's the one candidate who's actually said, hey, I want to learn more about this. I want to understand this. And I want to figure out what we can do about it. And I don't just want to tell folks the legislation that I support. I don't just want to tell people, yep, I'm going to check the box saying I'm for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Because the truth is, Sly, that's not enough. And you're talking to a guy who helped start the Fight for 15 in a union movement. $15 an hour minimum wage isn't enough. It's also not enough to have a set of things that you support as legislation, set of policies that you would sign if they were adopted by the legislature. Because we all know that in the most gerrymandered state in the country, that's not a plan to govern, to build the power of workers and to raise wages. That's a plan to pontificate. What we need is a governor that understands what power they can exercise as governor, using their executive authority to change the rules of the game here. And I think that's where Malin has really distinguished himself. The guy who's marched and rallied with us, the guy who's met and talked with us, not surprisingly, has the best handle on what can be done to build worker power and raise wages. And the truth is, he's got a track record his entire adult life fighting for and winning for working class people. I think this is a guy who, taking office on day one, is going to be ready to lead a new fight for workers to win in Wisconsin again.
There are some that talk about the economic message that Bernie talked about, Russ Feingold talked about over the years, Sherrod Brown talked about over the years. There's a real differentiation within the Democratic Party, even with Joe Biden, who kind of sounds blue collar, but frankly, his voting record is not all that blue collar.
The senator from MBNA in Delaware.
It's hard not to like him, but he was a senator from Delaware and was in the Obama administration that really fell short on this stuff. You know, the Wall Street Journal wrote a piece about Milwaukee back in the day, called it the Star of the Snow Belt. And one of the things that many Hillary Clinton supporters sort of used to divide the Bernie thing was a racial divide, to say you're not speaking to black people when you're talking about these issues. But the truth is, when the factories were in Milwaukee, before the demise of the 30th Street Corridor, African Americans were doing better in Milwaukee than the national average.
Oh, this was the best place in the country to raise a family if you were part of the black working class. It's now the worst. And the biggest difference between the heyday of Milwaukee's industrial economy and today is that the number of workers that are represented by unions in working class jobs has basically been eliminated. It's gone from tens of thousands. You could literally draw a line, as you noted, up 30th Street and put a line 2 miles to the east, 2 miles to the west, maybe not even that, and touch, oh, I don't know, probably 50,000 union jobs in factories. And they employed predominantly people of color, black folks on Milwaukee's north side. That's no longer the case. And, you know, in our city right now, demographically, the overwhelming share of people of color are employed in low-wage service sector jobs that certainly don't pay anywhere near a living wage. In fact, they pay folks wages that trap them in poverty and provide no real hope for the future. That's why we are the worst city in the country for black folks. That's why we have the largest amount of segregation in the metro area in America. And, you know, I think that anyone who wants to get out there and say, well, you know, that populist economic message doesn't speak to black and brown folk is, you know, either ignorant or disingenuous. And every day our union here is talking with hundreds, thousands even, of workers of color, working class people of color from the north side and the near south side of Milwaukee. And, you know, people don't give folks enough credit, you know, from the black and brown working class. They want to ascribe to them some sort of lack of understanding about, you know, our past. And, you know, we have training sessions for folks and ask the question of, you know, what's the biggest difference between now and the way it used to be in Milwaukee? And you know, want folks to look to what the difference will be between now and the future. And we ask folks what it would take to change that. And, you know, inevitably, in every single session that we have, people identify the lack of power that they have. And they understand that black and brown workers used to have much more power in Milwaukee, power in the economy. And that, you know, led to a decline in wages and living standards. So I think that when you look at the realities, the demographics, the economics, and even the political science of this, you know, there is a large black and brown working class that looks to the political arena to help working people build the power they need to change their living standards, to improve them, to strengthen them. And to say that a populist economic message doesn't speak to black and brown folks, I think it's just preposterous. I do want to add, though, Sly, that's not enough. That's not enough of a political message. I think there, one, needs to be an acknowledgement that, in fact, for black and brown working class people, things are different. Racism is real. It plays out in a lot of different ways. But racism isn't just the person being told, well, you know, you can't go to this place, or something that, you know, we think is in our past, like you can't drink out of this drinking fountain or you need to be in the back of the bus. Racism is also something that plays out in institutions and structures where, you know, people of color in this city are by and large employed in low-wage service sector jobs, and that's not the case for white folks. You also need to be able to talk about the connection between how black and brown working class people have been, you know, put in this place economically as part of a deliberate systemic structure that links also up with the system of mass incarceration and over-policing in communities of color. So I just think that this sort of like Clintonite, third way New Democrat approach to talking about race and class in the political arena conceals more than it reveals. It tells us that these politicians that don't want to take on the fact that the billionaire class in Wall Street has in fact rigged the economy to their benefit at the expense of the rest of us, they don't want to talk about these things because they've got a particular ideological view of the world. And so they distract and say, well, that doesn't speak to black and brown workers. You're not addressing race. And the truth is they're showing everything that we need to know about their own colors when they want to talk about things as if they're cabined and siloed off. Because the black and brown working class folks that are part of our organization don't look at it that way. And in fact, they're coming here every day saying, we need to fight for worker power so that we can raise wages. That's the number one issue for black and brown working people in Milwaukee. That's what they say. That's not what we say. We're responding to them. So I think that's what politicians like Bernie are doing and need to do as well.
And of course, many of the Clinton wing of the party are also taking advantage of the fact that Trump has sort of fumbled a clear and cohesive message or coherent message on trade. And so they're taking advantage of that. And they're, it's kind of like, I feel like I'm reliving the mid-1990s. They're back and forth. They see an opportunity and they're pretending that free trade is somehow good for cities like Milwaukee or the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's like we're through the looking glass, though, in a weird way where, you know, because Trump is pushing, you know, some bastardized version of protectionism, some weird version of, you know, what ought to be sort of straightforward things that you do to ensure that American industries, you know, have the strength that they need and are playing on, if not, you know, a level playing field, not one so slanted against them. Because Trump is pushing that, you get Democrats jumping up and saying, well, oh my gosh, you know, we need free trade. We need unfettered free trade. We need to make that a priority because they just want to be oppositional to Trump. But it does nothing to actually, you know, address the realities of what a global trade regime has done to screw workers in America. And by the way, it's screwed workers in, you know, the global South as well, too. So this trade system that we have has been, it's part of that rigged system, Sly. It's been built by the billionaire class on Wall Street to benefit them at the expense of working class people. Doesn't matter if they're white, black, or brown. Doesn't matter if they're in America or across the border or across an ocean. And so we need Democrats that will actually get up there and speak to the realities of this, not simply knee-jerk react against Trump, talk about, you know, free trade this, free trade that, because Trump is talking protectionism. We need to have a very real conversation in this country about the role that trade plays and who it benefits and why that is.
Well, it is interesting that the one Democrat in a red-leaning state who's doing the best this year is Sherrod Brown, and he's always kept his eye on the ball on that issue. Stand by. We'll talk. Go ahead.
I think he's the most forceful and eloquent voice on trade in a substantial and serious way here. And the big thing, Sly, is he treats the voters of Ohio like they're adults and can understand complex issues. I think he's a fantastic messenger for all of us.
Stand by. We'll talk more with Peter Rickman from MASH at Sly'sOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who's going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep Sly'sOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from Sly'sOffice.com. We're back at Sly'sOffice.com. Peter Rickman with us. Peter is a longtime labor activist. He's been involved with a number of different organizations over the year. Right now, he's with the Milwaukee Service and Hospitality Workers Organization, otherwise known as MASH. So, Peter, tell me a little bit about what's new in your fight. I know the Republicans have thrown more obstacles in your direction with project labor agreements, labor peace agreements. Tell us how you've maneuvered around that, what you're doing, and can you give us some good news?
Yeah, well, look, Sly, it's no surprise to any of us or your listeners that Republicans in Wisconsin are seeking to erect barriers to workers' building power. But I think that any time that they legislate some new hassle, some new obstacle, some new block in the road, you know, we just sort of have to go around or through it. In Milwaukee, as some of your listeners may remember, our organization, MASH, launched as the union in the hiring hall for service and hospitality workers in the Bucks Arena District. And I am looking out the window of my office, and I see that new arena glistening in this beautiful July sun, and that thing's ready to open. So what we've been doing here is working to get almost 1,000 people into jobs in the arena district, and not only get them into those jobs prepared to take employment, but to keep employment and to build a career pathway. And we've been working to help those folks also build their union on the way in so that we can win collective bargaining for 1,000 to 2,000 private sector workers in the service and hospitality industries in downtown Milwaukee. I'd say that's some pretty damn good news, Sly, because that's the sort of thing that not only is going to change the realities here for that 1,000 to 2,000 workers and their families, but it's also going to raise hope. It's going to raise expectations for other workers in Milwaukee that we can do something different. And I think that's how we can also point the way to working class people around the state that we can win again. We need different models. We need different approaches. The Bucks Arena District itself is sort of the seed that is being planted for developing a new form of worker organization, new means to raise standards and bargain collectively. And, you know, Sly, when workers at the airport in Milwaukee heard about what was going on, they said, we want a Bucks agreement too. And we've been working with them to build their fight. And this is much more of a classic, you know, take the fight right to the boss kind of organizing campaign. But about 100 workers in the food service and hospitality industry in New York, in Milwaukee, I was looking at something that said New York on it. I apologize for that. But 100 food service and hospitality workers in Milwaukee are bringing the fight to the boss because they've seen workers win here in Milwaukee. And so we think that we have a chance to continue to spread and expand this model to help other workers win. And we're developing and beginning to test some of the ways that we can expand this model of what we call sectoral bargaining, you know, collective bargaining for workers across a whole sector of the economy in Milwaukee. And it's one of the main reasons that we said we need to throw down for Malin Mitchell as our endorsed candidate. For one, he understands that we need to raise standards. We need to build power to raise wages for workers across whole industries. You can't do it employer by employer, worksite by worksite. That's not the way of the world, particularly with service and hospitality industry employment. And, you know, he has outlined a plan to actually make that a reality. And so the very same folks who've come through our doors to find employment in the service and hospitality industry jobs in the Bucks Arena District and the thousands more out there in the community that we talk to every day, quite literally, we talk to thousands of people about this, are saying, well, we want a Buck-style agreement for living wages and union rights and a hiring hall for all the jobs in Milwaukee in these service and hospitality industries. They're the folks who are building the fighting force to help get someone like Malin Mitchell elected and to take things to the next level then to win, again, what we call sectoral bargaining. It's politically constructed sectoral bargaining. That's a really, that's a lot of syllables, a lot of words for the next generation of how we're going to build worker power, build unions, and raise wages here, not only in Milwaukee but across Wisconsin. So, I think
how do you do it? Obviously, the Bucks owners are not garden variety capitalists. They're capitalists, but they're not garden variety capitalists. A little more benevolent, a little more open to dialogue. And to be honest, the governor signed off on this because he needed Democratic votes. Taking nothing away from your hard work, and you worked really hard to make this happen and should take great pride in that. How do you get those confluences together again with other projects?
Well, and let me say this, Sly. There was a movement in the streets and at the ballot box that set the backdrop for being able to win a 15 and a union agreement around the Bucks Arena District. I think, you know, you've used that phrase now, politically constructed collective bargaining. How to expand, to spread the model, to systematize what's been done around the Bucks Arena District is not going to happen in the same way. That was a unique confluence of circumstances. You know, there was a need in the legislature, in the state capitol, for votes for this mega project that included hundreds of millions of dollars in public subsidies. And, you know, that became part of the deal, so to speak. Now, we're not going to change the lives of 50,000 workers in the service and hospitality industry in Milwaukee with deals like that left and right. It's not realistic. To say nothing of the, you know, 1.2 million plus workers in Wisconsin who
go to their jobs every day and bring home a paycheck every 2 weeks that doesn't pay them a living wage. We're not going to do it with big community benefits agreement deals where there's leverage around. We're going to do it because we build a policy structure here in Wisconsin that creates the mechanism for workers to raise wages. And if I could like get a little nerdy for you here a minute, I'll try to keep this slide as sort of straightforward as possible. We envision a Wisconsin where wage floors for every job in, say, any given industry. Let's use hospitals, for example, because this is actually a pretty straightforward one in terms of putting this into place. Every job in any hospital in a geographic area should have the same basic wage floor. So if we're talking about CNAs, or we're talking about food service, we're talking about the janitors or environmental services, or we're talking about, you know, nurses on the floor. Every person who works one of these jobs in any given geographic area ought to be paid the exact same amount, at least at the floor. Now, any given employer might pay them more than that, but we should have a floor set. That's something that should be determined between all the employers and all the workers in that industry, again, on a geographic basis. We can't do it hospital by hospital, system by system. It should apply to, for example, all the hospitals mm-hmm. in the Green Bay area should have the same wage floor for CNAs. And if they want to do more than that, that's fine, whatever. But it should be bargained between the workers who are employed in those jobs and the employers. And, you know, maybe you want to have some representatives of the public and the common good be part of that as well. Through policies, we can construct a collective bargaining mechanism for those parties to negotiate over this, say on an annual basis or a biannual basis, something like that. You can put this model into place across all industries, or a number of them at least, where minimum economic standards are bargained. And then you can expand that to minimum standards of working conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And here's where it, I think, gets really interesting, Sly. If employers in that industry are choosing their representatives at the table to bargain that sectoral standard, and workers are choosing their representatives as well, they're electing their people, and they can join an organization, you start to get a world in which unions are organizing and representing workers on a sectoral basis. It looks a little different than what we have right now with union contracts being one employer, one work site at a time. We're looking here at something that happens on an industry-wide basis, a sectoral basis. That requires policies in place, and that's why we need to put a governor in office who understands the importance of building worker power to raise wages and raise standards, but also has some view about how we can do that and is really committed to driving that all the way through, whether it's through executive orders, personnel right. appointments, the use of the budget process.
You know, I had to chuckle the other day. Senator Baldwin has introduced her legislation about Buy America for making sure that, and really this has been in the law for a long time, but there have been all these loopholes, trying to close loopholes. So the federal government buys Americans, so we support American workers. And James Wigerson from Wright, Wisconsin, was attacking her for it, saying that Buy American provision is going to cost taxpayers money, and it's going to go up against market forces. And yeah, I thought to myself, the market, are you talking about low-wage jobs in China? Is that the market? We've become such a distorted society and so rather transactional about all this stuff that I think we've lost sight. Whatever you label yourself politically, what you're doing right now should make capitalists in Milwaukee actually happy.
Well, or the state of Wisconsin. I don't wake up every day thinking about making capitalists
I understand
happy.
That.
I think you've pointed out something, though, that's really crucial here, Sly. We need to stop, you know, cease immediately the slavish devotion to the god of free market fundamentalism. It's antithetical to human values.
Well, there really is no such thing as a free market.
you're entirely right. It is the use of the words free and market, capital F, capital M, as a disguise for the billionaire class on Wall Street rigging a system in their favor. That's what they want us to believe the free market is. They keep all the power. They keep all the profits. And what we're talking about here, and what workers are, I think, you know, and what we found so far are willing to fight for, is a way to unrig the system and balance the power and recognize that economic standards, for example, are set on the basis of a labor market. And I think that's the case when you're talking about, for example, textile production, uniforms for government employees. You know, the labor market for that is not set in, you know, any one place. I'm trying to think, you know, where they used to produce these, in North Carolina. You know, that used to be a textile center for production of sort of institutional uniforms, Inc. No, the textile and garment labor market is set on the basis of the global production marketplace. And so that's the location for where wage standards need to be set. And the idea that, for example, we're going to allow you know, garment workers in Indonesia or Thailand, Cambodia, Laos to make, you know, government employee uniforms for 13 cents an hour because that's good for the government dime. And that means that jobs in North Carolina are destroyed entirely. Living wage jobs are destroyed entirely. Well, I just don't think that's something that people in this country, whether it's in Wisconsin or anywhere in all the other 49 states, are really interested in. So we need to take that to the next level.
Even
there's a whole bunch more we can do.
Even Jesse,
you know, how
even,
don't work for us.
Even Jesse Helms understood that.
I just, I bet you didn't think
I was going to compliment Jesse Helms in this podcast.
You know,
even Jesse Helms understood that.
And broken clock slide. I think that this is a moment though, Sly, and this is one reason I get excited every day to come into my office and then to get out in the field to talk to workers, because there's a growing recognition that the way that capitalism has been structured is failing workers, and that people recognize it and understand it, but that it goes beyond that. They're not just understanding, well, woe is us and this is terrible. They're saying, well, there's ways we can fight it and there's ways we can change it. And we think that there's a real plan to win around that. That's sort of unique in my lifetime. I'm 36 years old and I don't remember necessarily, and I'm a bit of a student of history, as you know, I don't remember there being a time when, you know, there was this similar confluence of factors where workers are identifying that there is a problem, a large-scale systemic problem, and are saying, we need to fight it. We can. We've got a plan. And people are in motion around it. And I think that this is this election coming up actually is a really signal time in whether we can continue to make progress and advance. We think we've got a really great plan for how we're going to raise wages and living standards by building worker power with a new version of how working class people bargain with employers, bargain with capital. And that's just one of a number of examples. I think we're seeing people in motion. They're ready to fight. They're willing to fight. The question is whether politicians will come along for the ride with us.
Peter Rickman with MASH. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.